Hello and welcome to Start Your Week from the Bunker. I'm Andrew Harrison. It seems very clear that what's going to continue to dominate the week ahead will be the continuing distressing scenes from Afghanistan and the bickering amongst Western leaders in the wake of what's been described as America's cut and run from the country. We're hearing of people being trampled, shootings and rape of civilians at Kabul airport. At least 20 people have died there. We've seen a lack of coordination between Western powers and provision for refugees on makeshift and piecemeal. Here to look ahead at these miserable prospects, plus a couple more of this week's stories, is Naomi Smith, Chief Executive of Best for Britain. Good morning, Naomi. How are you?
Yeah, good morning, Andrew. Still feeling deeply ashamed of the West, basically. It's all still very grim and makes me feel sick to my stomach, if we're honest.
Yes, it has been. It's been a dismal weekend preceded by a dismal week. Are we seeing any sign coordination for Afghanistan might improve, that any better provision for refugees than what we saw in the panicked response of last week?
Well, what's happened over the weekend is reports of, I think, around 20 Afghans that have been killed at Kabul airport. I think most of them in crashes on the approach. So as the crowd swell and more and more people join the back of the queue, people being crushed to death. So against that backdrop, I think we should say no. You know, people are still prepared to risk their lives in order to escape. The slight movement there has been twofold. So first of all, Boris Johnson obviously is currently chairing G7. And over the weekend, he has said ahead of their virtual meeting this week, he is going to be pressing the US for slower withdrawal from Kabul. If you remember, the deadline that Biden has said is that all US troops will be out of the country by the 31st of August, which of course is next week, so not very long at all. And also Biden has told CNN that the US will extend the safe zone around Kabul airport, and that there are, quote, discussions about whether the full withdrawal will still go ahead on the 31st of August or not. He's saying that's still the ambition, but for the first time, there seems to be a little bit of doubt creeping in against the backdrop of world condemnation about the speed of withdrawal.
There are fears that thousands of people with British connections are going to miss the chance to be evacuated, not entirely down to the Americans, down to our own government's failure to act quickly. You know, the embarrassing story that the ambassador was at the airport personally processing.
Good man.
The story of the weekend has been the British government's slow response, and particularly Rab on the beach, Conservatives continuing to savage their own government. Firstly, has Rab survived this? Because he looks pretty much like he's got past the Hancock barrier. Has he survived it? Is he damaged goods now?
Well, I mean, he was pretty damaged beforehand, having embarrassed himself many, many times. Most infamously, everyone will remember about having to point out the strategic importance of Dover to an island nation in terms of trade. I think he will survive because Johnson doesn't want him to be held to a high standard, lest those standards apply to others like him and, of course, the Prime Minister himself. The other story that came out over the weekend, briefed to the Sunday papers, was that it was Johnson who had authorised Rab to have his holiday and to allow him to stay on the beach, which of course doesn't look good for Johnson at all. I think probably what we're looking at, though, is Rob being reshuffled in a bigger shakeup coming in, you know, maybe weeks or it was meant to be in a couple of months. That might get brought forward, but it'll be hidden within a reshuffle of lots of them. Now, the other thing to remember is that all is not well around the cabinet table at all. Relations between senior ministers and number 10 are pretty precarious. You'll remember that Rishi Sunak fell out with the Prime Minister over pushing for faster unlockdowns. The Gavin Williamson scandals just, you know, keep coming. Priti Patel has been criticised for not getting on top of the channel crossings as effectively as she should. And, you know, there have been issues with Grant Shapps as well in terms of transport. So there is a high likelihood, I would think, that Rab survives this immediate catastrophe, but that his sins won't go unpunished in a bigger reshuffle and will get hidden in a wider shakeup later on.
But it does make you ask yourself, who can they replace Rab with? If you're driven to putting someone like Rab in position already, if he's the best you can get, who's the next best? I mean, it makes you think that our next foreign secretary can be even more dismal.
Yeah, I mean, and I think that is true of most of the top positions. And we often talk about, you know, the low quality of politician that there is in Parliament since the expenses scandal in the late noughties. So look, I'm not going to speculate about who, because, you know, who knows? But you're right, you know, there is very little talent there to draw from. And of course, loyalty will be the prime deciding factor rather than skill set. I mean, I think we're already, most of us, missing, dare I say it, Hancock's influence on controlling coronavirus in the wake of Sajid Javid taking over and Delta running ever more, you know, out of control, numbers definitely going quite dangerously in the wrong direction in terms of hospitalizations and deaths.
Recrimination between Britain and the United States and, to a lesser extent, the European Union continued to fester over the weekend. Tony Blair described the withdrawal as being in pursuit of an imbecilic slogan about ending forever wars. I'm struggling to think of a worse low for US-UK relations. Can you?
No, indeed. And I, you know, I agree with Tony Blair. We could have managed the situation with very little effort by comparison to the effort expended. And I say we, the West, not we necessarily the UK, but by comparison to efforts in South Korea and elsewhere. He's right that it's not only horrendous for women, atheists, gay people and other Afghans, but it's dangerous for the whole West because of what this means in terms of Al-Qaeda, ISIS, etc., as well as the Taliban, and people being very concerned about suicide bombers attacking those trying to make their way to Kabul airport. And I guess that is what that intelligence is what is driving Biden saying that they're going to try and expand the safe zone around the airport. Back to relations between the UK and the US, when we look at what's happening in the US, moderate Republicans who backed him seem to be waning in their support for him. Of course, over Afghanistan, there are still thought to be several thousand US citizens in Afghanistan. And of course, the images of babies being thrown over barbed wire fences, people falling from fuselage are going to haunt him for the rest of his political career. But there are also concerns about the Delta variant running rampage in the US again. In terms of US-UK relations, I just find this so predictably appalling that the UK, of course, has sort of severed diplomatic relations with many of its allies in Europe and the European Union itself in the hope that, you know, the US would have its back. The US hasn't. And what we now don't have is this very coordinated NATO and EU pressure group on the US to do the right thing. Were Britain still a big fish within Europe, it would be much harder for Biden to be ignoring the rest of the West, if you like, whereas now it knows the UK is very much more isolated. And so we just have lost that global soft power we once wielded, or it is certainly greatly diminished.
Well, I mean, 12 months ago, you'd have said that we were most likely to fall out with the United States over Northern Ireland and the British government's nonchalant, irresponsible treatment of the Good Friday Agreement. You would not have predicted that we would fall out over this, that Biden would honour Trump's precipitous quick deal, which is now looks increasingly like a time bomb left underneath the Biden presidency. You would not have predicted that we would be falling out over Afghanistan, given how faithful Britain has been to Americans' policy under different prime ministers over the past 20 years.
Indeed, and we're in that unfortunate situation where we are now going to probably fall out with them over both Northern Ireland and Afghanistan.
Yes, and attempt to do a trade deal with them at the same time.
I think that is very firmly on the back burner. Yeah, in news that will be a relief to anyone who's concerned about hormone beef and chlorinated chicken.
Going back to the state of Biden's popularity and the perceptions of the competence of his administration, Democrats in the US are very concerned about this, about a probable collapse of confidence in Biden. They are concerned that the moderate center voters who supported him last time might be driven away by this, exactly the scenes you just described. Republicans have launched congressional investigations into the administration's handling of the withdrawal. How serious a political crisis is this for him? I mean, considering the noise the Republicans made over Benghazi, this is of a vastly greater magnitude and a clearly serious ineptitude.
The moderate Republicans on whom he relied in order to get into the White House are the very Republicans who would have been skeptical of Trump. He does rely on them for continued support. It is looking bad. You know, this isn't, I mean, you know, to the extent that this is filtered through to voters yet, I think is to be seen. And certainly last week, polling seemed to suggest there was confidence for Biden's approach, you know, get out of Afghanistan, our boys have done enough, support for that withdrawal. I think only a third of voters saying that they'd disagreed with the withdrawal, which was, you know, it's a staggering poll rating compared to that we were seeing across Europe. But it is certainly hurting him with moderate Republicans in the Senate, in the House, and even some of his own Democrats. You know, there are governors and others across the country flexing their muscles and saying this is not good enough. We are not happy with this. Look, there aren't elections happening imminently, so, you know, maybe he's got time to turn this around. And much of the rest of his agenda has been incredibly popular. Make no mistake, this is an enormous dent in Biden's ability to hold that broad coalition together that was essentially an anti-Trump coalition. He needed to build it into a pro-Biden coalition. And at the moment, that seems to be slipping through his fingers fairly quickly.
The optics are diabolical. Biden's brand in the election was empathy, was, you know, end the madness and care for other Americans. He has looked callous in this episode, dismissing the fate of Afghanistan, putting it in the hands of its own people. I mean, you're a political campaigner. What happens when you go against your brand, when you present yourself not as the person that people elected, but as a very different person?
I mean, I think that's a very good point, Andrew. And rather than sort of think about it in terms of brand, I think you have to talk about it in terms of authenticity. People may not necessarily like a politician or a candidate, but they might believe in what they stand for. You see this hugely with people like Farage, George Galloway. You know, populist kinds of politicians do well because people actually do believe what they say. They seem to be so purist that they stand away from their common criticism of politicians that they'll say one thing and do another.
Yeah, what they say is appalling, but at least they believe it.
I believe what they're saying. Yeah. Now you can triangulate in politics, and you often have to in order to build those broad coalitions, etc. But you can never deviate too far from the, as you say, the brand, the values, the principles that underpin the very fundamentals of who they believe you to be. And when you do, it becomes a trust issue. And trust is the lack of trust is the biggest risk to politicians the world over. And he will have lost the trust of more hawkish people, but just as you say, those with compassion. And that's not just because of the withdrawal. That's probably also because of the limited appetite for taking in Afghan refugees that we've seen from many Western states, but you know, chiefly from those that really could afford to be taking far more than they proposed to, the UK included.
Well, back here, you haven't seen much of it in the legitimate media, but on social media, the refugee debate has gone quite toxic again over the weekend. When you've got even Tom Harwood of GB News getting roasted for saying that people who flee Islamists should be allowed into the UK. I mean, there was a huge response. No room here. We're full. Exactly what you'd expect of the nativist right in this country. You've said on our other podcast that overall the British public are in favour of helping. It polls favourably that we should be taking in people who are fleeing the Taliban. How can you see that developing this week? Do you think the refugee debate is going to become more central?
I hope so. Last week there was an absolutely devastating piece in Devon Online about the leader of the Liberal Democrat group on Tor Bay Council, who said we can't have any Afghan refugees settled in Tor Bay because we are so under-resourced from all of the cuts that we can't possibly take them in. Oh, and because we don't really have much of a migrant community here, they won't feel very welcome. And he has, you know, rightly been lambasted by other Lib Dem councillors within his group. But if you even have Liberal Democrat councillors waving the flag for nativism in the UK, then you can only imagine how the far right are seizing on this issue. And, you know, just a very quick glance at Farage's Twitter feed shows you how thrilled he is with this situation, because it gives him more cause to ramp up his anti-immigrant xenophobic rhetoric. But yes, you're right. We are fundamentally a very compassionate people when it comes to extreme situations like this. And there has always been a difference in this country between hostility towards what is perceived to be economic migrants and then those seeking sanctuary who need shelter and safety and peace from the situation that they are fleeing from. So I hope that more pressure will be applied, but at the moment it doesn't seem like the UK is going to revisit its figure of taking more than 20,000 refugees over the long term. And indeed, overnight I saw stories that we are now beginning to erect offshore processing centres. We've outsourced and offshored call centres for the last couple of decades. Now we are seeking, apparently, to offshore processing centres in countries around and nearer to Afghanistan in order to be able to process them. That said, I did see that the figure for the number that we're hoping to take is actually 6,000 this year now rather than 5,000, because I think we are speeding up the process of getting people through. But I don't think it will have an impact on that overall 20,000 number just yet. So, yeah, people need to put pressure on their MPs to let Parliament know that we are a tolerant, open and welcoming country that wants to help these people.
On to a couple of other topics before we wrap up. COVID, as you say, cases are still creeping up. They're up to 26,413 on the 7-day average by the weekend. Deaths are still in the low 80s. In this morning's news, the government is removing around 50 companies from the list of approved COVID-19 testing providers. The founder of one provider, Random, says the PCR market needs cleaning out. And also there's a new finger prick antibody test program being rolled out for COVID positive people. Are we now accepting that this is going to be a permanent part of healthcare? That, you know, this is going to be, as with your annual flu jab, as with your various tests for mammograms and prostates and all this kind of thing, you know, COVID healthcare is going to be just a permanent feature?
Well, I think we've long known that COVID is something we're going to have to live with. The zero COVID ambition that some countries originally tried to pursue is probably a fantasy. That said, the antibody test program, as I understand it, is a voluntary experiment for those that test positive through and register their positive test through the app, then get sent a finger prick test, which they can or cannot use should they want to, you know, test their blood, send it off in the post for it to be analysed, because there is some research beginning to show that we are all having quite different antibody reactions to the vaccines and to developing COVID ourselves. And so this is part of a bigger research program to try and identify who is most at risk and therefore needing different types of booster or different types of advice from government about shielding if they aren't producing the immune response that you would typically expect from having had exposure to the viruses, either through having caught it yourself or vaccination. So, you know, everyone is coming to terms with the fact that this is a new normal, but the antibody test isn't a mandatory program yet, as I understand it.
Meanwhile, scientists in Britain are examining whether to use smaller doses of the vaccine in the booster programs that are going to be coming in the autumn. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, apparently it's very good for helping you concentrate at work. This will increase the supply of shots available around the world. Are we finally getting a bit of a global perspective on vaccines?
I'm about bloody time. You know, WHO and others for a long while have been saying it is much more important to get first and second shots into the arms of absolutely everybody than it is to be rolling out regular boosters for everyone. So I suspect this is part of some kind of climb down or U-turn or whatever from richer countries on that. So yes, this story is basically saying, can we halve the doses in order to double the supply that we've got? You know, does everybody that requires a booster need the full shebang each time, or will a lower dose give them the boost and immunity that they'll need to get them through the next few months, allowing us then to portion out more first and second dose vaccines to the rest of the world, which, as we know, is vital if we are ever to get back to a situation where we aren't so concerned about new variants cropping up, vaccine resistant variants, you know, popping up, etc., because of the large numbers of countries around the world that remain incredibly low in terms of their vaccination population rate.
Finally, before we go, it's time for Naomi to play the hits. Supply chains continue to be stretched by Brexit and COVID. The Times had a story at the weekend that Christmas is already cancelled. The British Poultry Council says turkey production will be 20% lower than last year because of a lack of seasonal workers. We're still short of 90,000 lorry drivers. And the Casino Owner Rank Group said it's struggling to get hold of halloumi and Sauvignon Blanc in recent weeks. Must we live like animals? Naomi, autumn's the busiest time for everything, not just food, but, you know, delivery of everything from electronics to any kind of goods you can name. Yeah. Can you see this getting worse as we go into the autumn?
It is going to get worse because the government has no plan beyond a couple of very measly measures like lowering the threshold for passing your HGV driving test to try and get more experts back on the roads, delivering us the goods that we need in time for things like Black Friday and Christmas. However, what is happening is inflation. Wage inflation, because there is such a small pool of people who can drive left in the country now that we have left the EU and are no longer lucky enough to be having the large numbers of EU drivers bringing us our stuff. So there are all sorts of golden handcuff bonuses happening. Some companies offering drivers £1,000 sign-on bonus, £1,000 retention bonus, some companies even more. And of course, the bigger companies like Tesco are able to do this and able to absorb some of that cost, but the big discounters, the Aldis and Lidls, and others that operate on, you know, very, very, very small margins, just don't have that bandwidth without passing on that cost to customers. And then you've got the much smaller organisations. We've heard that convenience store chain McColl's is saying, you know, this is going to mean that we have far fewer stuff on our shelves. They simply cannot afford to be paying the premiums to get drivers to deliver stuff. The big impact it's going to have is on range. So there will probably be products on the shelves, but you will not have anywhere near the range of choices to choose from. You know, maybe only a couple of types of baked bean rather than the shelf that we're used to seeing with hundreds of different brands or dozens of different brands on there. And it's not just things that, you know, we're concerned about in terms of Christmas, like turkeys and chickens and toys being impacted. Actually, Best of Britain got a scoop last week, thanks to Alexandre. We put it on our Twitter. A leading research university has said to its staff, and we've seen the leaked internal email, saying that gas bottles are in short supply to hold CO2. Now, this is critically important, as we understand it, in terms of incubators within research labs, including those that do COVID research work. And so the missive had gone out to researchers saying, you know, please turn off all machinery that you're not currently using at the moment, because we cannot guarantee that we are going to be able to supply CO2 into the labs as a direct consequence of all of these supply chain issues linked to Brexit. Every Remainer in the country will be shouting, jumping up and down, saying, I told you so, I told you so. This probably isn't something that's permeated through to the public consciousness just yet. But if anything will, it will be not having your turkey crown on the dining table on Christmas Day.
I can just see the express letters now going, I thought we had too much CO2. Now the Ramonas are saying we haven't got enough. Letter of the week, Daily Express. Finally, the Association of Independent Meat Suppliers is asking to be allowed to use prisoners to replace workers lost to Brexit and COVID. Some producers already have inmates on temporary license programs working for them. As a vegan, I'm sure you're not all that bothered about the state of the meat trade, Naomi, but is this the Brexit people voted for?
Well, you say as a vegan, but actually the alternative is that these animals just get slaughtered and ditched. So meat processing isn't about farm workers. It's about the places where the birds get defeathered, processed, minced, whatever, you know, goes on. And as a vegan, obviously, you know, I would, of course, rather people weren't consuming meat. But if we are breeding those animals, then surely it's better for them to go into the food chain than to just be slaughtered for no benefit to anyone whatsoever. One Suffolk prison has said that it's already reached its quota in supplying prison workers. Yeah, I mean, look, it's staggering, basically, that we've got to this stage where we just are such a unattractive destination for people to come and work here. B, that, you know, we make it so incredibly difficult for those that do, and C, that, you know, we didn't have any kind of mitigation in place for this incredibly predictable scenario.
Putting prisoners into the meat industry. I don't think we're at Soylent Green levels just yet, but I don't know, maybe it'll come. Naomi, thanks for joining me and getting up early for Start Your Week.
Thanks very much, Andrew. Sorry it was a bit of a Debbie Downer one, but hey, that's
hey, we don't write the news, we just talk about it. Listeners, thanks for listening. As you know, we have new dailies every Monday to Thursday and at the weekend too. If you liked this show or our past editions, why not forward them to 3 friends? We're asking people to spread the word for us. We'd love to hear the feedback from new listeners and from you as well. So if you're listening on your phone now, there is a share button right in front of you. Send it to some friends and see what they think. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.